And would you all please stand for the reading of God's Word? Paul's letter to the Romans, chapter 1, verses 18 through 21 is where we are going to be at this morning. The title of the sermon is simply, Give Thanks. Paul writes, he says, "For the wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men, who by their unrighteousness suppress the truth. For what can be known about God is plain to them, because God has shown it to them. For his invisible attributes, namely his eternal power and divine nature, have been clearly perceived ever since the creation of the world, in the things that have been made. So they are without excuse. For although they knew God, they did not honor him as God or give thanks to him. But they became futile in their thinking, and their foolish hearts were darkened." Blessed is the one who reads aloud these words. You may be seated. As we approach Thanksgiving coming up this Thursday, as we found out a moment ago, I've selected this text that I think maybe some of you may be familiar where this is going. Others of you may be scratching your heads going, Romans 1, Thanksgiving, what is the connection? But I think this is a really key text for us as Christians, as we consider what we're about to step into this week, in terms of our Thanksgiving that's nationally celebrated, but also our Thanksgiving is personally celebrated. And so I would just commend this to you as we enter into this text. Let's be sensitive to what the Spirit would tell us today through his word in relation to this time in which we find ourselves, approaching this Thursday in this time of Thanksgiving. As many of you know, this letter was written by Paul. This is one of his longer letters, actually, written by the apostle. He wrote this to the church in Rome that was actually quite divided. And this letter is a letter of unity that he's writing to this church that was divided between Gentile or non-Jewish Christians and Jewish Christians. And he's writing this letter to intentionally show them some things about the gospel that they need to see, that they need to be reminded of, that they need to look at squarely in order for this church to have unity and to come together again in the way that is appropriate. And so Paul lays out the gospel for this church very plainly for them to see. And speaking of the gospel, the good news, the late R.C. Sproul has said this. Some of you may be familiar with this phrase that he said. He said, "The gospel is only good news when we understand the bad news." And I would say, let's even take this one step further and say, we really, in order to understand the good news, we have to understand the bad news. But in order to understand why the bad news is bad, we have to look back to see the very good creation which was marred by our sin. In order to know why the bad news is really bad, we have to look all the way back to the very creation moment, the beginning of everything, where God pronounces that our world is very good. And so Paul, in this portion of his letter, he's shedding light on exactly what is bad about the bad news. And that's where we're going today. So as we dive into this text together, I really hope and pray and maybe even plead with you to ask God's Spirit to help you ruminate on this key question related to your gratitude. And here's the question. Where is your thanks directed? I want us to think about that today, this morning. I want us to prayerfully think about it the rest of today and even this week as we approach Thanksgiving. Not are we thankful, but where is our thanks directed? To whom is our thanks ultimately directed? See, Romans tells us that right at the core of the problem in our hearts is a misdirection of, as Paul says, our honoring and our thanksgiving. He says this in verse 21, "For although they knew God, they did not honor him as God or give thanks to him," he says. Now, this misdirected worship Paul points to in this text as the reason that God gave them up. God gave them up because of this misdirected worship. He gave them up to impurity in verse 24. He gave them up to dishonorable passions in verse 26. He gave them up to a debased mind, verse 28. And these things led humanity to exchange numerous things. We see this word exchange take place in the rest of this passage numerous times. What did we exchange? Well, we exchanged the glory of the Creator for the glory of creation, verse 23. We exchanged the truth of God, verse 25, for a lie. We exchanged what is natural and according to God's wisdom with what is unnatural and actually goes against the wisdom of God. And these exchanges, it's not like we stepped into these exchanges thinking this is going to be bad, but humanity stepped into these exchanges thinking this is going to lead to flourishing. This was the promise of them. This is the promise of idolatry, is that you can flourish more having taken this on, having stepped into this wayward thinking and wayward living. The promise oftentimes says to us, says to you, says to me, you can sneak back into the garden through the back door. That's one way to think about the promise of idolatry coming at us. The lie, the promise coming at us says you can gain true freedom by taking yourself out from the authority of God in your life. That's what the lie says. You can find true freedom by removing authority from your life. The lie also says you can discover meaning and purpose by disconnecting yourself from your Maker, the one who put meaning and purpose in you from the beginning. It says you can actually find that another way. And this has led to the exchange that Paul talks about threefold here, exchanging of the glory of God for that of creation, the exchanging of the truth of God for a lie, the exchanging of God's wisdom for fallen, broken wisdom. This is the lie that we believed. And in Adam, we have corporately, this is a very important aspect of how we think about ourselves. We're so individualistically focused in Western culture that when we think about what Adam and Eve did, it's very easy for us to say, well, that was them, that's not me. But the way in which Scripture calls us to realize our place in this is to say, no, Adam was your corporate head, like a CEO makes decisions and his employees are infected maybe sometimes. Adam was our corporate head in a way. His decision has been made and we all in him made this decision. Biblically, this is where the Scriptures take us. And so when we recognize this and we see what Paul is talking about here, you and I are in this. You and I are a part of this. And the gospel, it confronts the falsehood of this lie. The gospel, it promises to restore us to our Creator. It promises to usher us back into God's presence, which is the main pinnacle of the garden, was the place where God walked with Adam and Eve in the cool of the day. His presence was felt and experienced. The gospel brings us back. The gospel fills us with true joy, true freedom, true satisfaction. The very thing that the idolatrous leanings of our world and even of our own heart tend to run after other things to find. The gospel actually does this for us. It addresses the core of the problem, that because of our rebellion against God, our hearts, your heart, my heart, the affections of which they are misdirected, and our honoring and our thanks is directed toward the creature rather than the Creator. This is where Paul is taking us. He's taking us right to the root of the problem, of the bad news. As we approach this very significant national holiday called Thanksgiving, I think it's important for us to kind of recall what we are celebrating this week, just to remind ourselves of what this is. There's obviously some debate about the origins of this holiday in America, but many believe this began around kind of the early 17th century by pilgrims, Puritans, who in essence wanted to express their thanks to God for his providential provision in their life. This is kind of the conventional sort of way in which many people believe Thanksgiving to have occurred. These men who came here, and women and families, they wanted to express their worship to God for how he had provided for them. Their worship was directed to God. Thanksgiving today, though, it feels very different than this, I think, even in my own reflections on it. Our thanks as a culture seem to be more kind of generically directed. Just thanks, right? Thanks to who? Fill in the blank. Thanks to your mom and dad. Thanks to your family. Thanks to your neighbor. Thanks to your company. Thanks to your boss. Thanks to all of these different sorts of places and people and things. And it's far less exclusively driven towards thanksgiving to God. I don't think it's not a stretch what I just said. Many of you are sitting there kind of with a look like, well, yeah, that's where we're at. And it's true. That's where we're at. But it's good for us to notice this and to be aware of this, this sort of generic way in which our thanks is directed. And I think all of this it's a part of our insistence to find meaning and purpose in the creation rather than the creator. And one thing for us to think about during Thanksgiving is this, that in our age of increased secular religion, I'll call it, it's not as though our hearts as a culture are less religious. It's not as though we've put religion down, but we've actually taken up a new religion, or a different religion, I'll say. We've taken up a different sort of devotion. I like how James K. Smith, a couple of years ago, he wrote an article for the Washington Post. Some of you are familiar with that name. He's written a number of excellent books. And he wrote this article for the Washington Post where he walked through the cultural liturgies, so like the religious practices of Thanksgiving, and particularly, some of you may find this interesting, of the football game on Thanksgiving Day. He walks through the cultural religious liturgies of Thanksgiving. And he makes some interesting observations, but one thing that he says, I'm not going to obviously read you the whole article, you can do that if you'd like, but one interesting thing that he says that I found so true as I think about our culture, he says this: in a secular age, he says, our religious impulses aren't diminished. They haven't lessened. They just find new devotions. They have just found new devotions, he says. Our religious impulses are not diminished. They've just found new devotions, a new direction for our worship. And the question for us is, where does this come from? What, as we see our society, as many of us are aware that this is sort of the water we're swimming in, the question for us this morning is, where does this come from? To which Paul clearly tells us in Romans 1 where this stems from. It stems from a lack of honoring God and giving thanks to whom it is due. Paul says in verse 18, he says, for the wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men who by their unrighteousness suppress the truth. Now, we struggle sometimes when we talk about the wrath of God. It's strange for someone to have a real eagerness to talk about it. That can be kind of weird, but that's not the norm for our culture and our society. We tend to, when we hear about the wrath of God, we tend to kind of wince a little bit. Okay, it's hard to hear about God's wrath, his just anger. I would say it's hard to hear unless we've been wronged against and we're calling out for God's wrath to be, you know, God, would you just issue your wrath on person A or person B over here? That's kind of easy. But when we think about God's wrath towards humanity, his righteous judgment, his anger that's directed towards us, that's not something that many of us like to just step into the brunt of and say, all right, bring it on. Let me hear about it. But Paul directs it right to us this morning in Romans 1. He talks about God's wrath towards us. And this is part of the problem. Our desire to not look at this squarely is actually part of the problem, I think Paul says. We have this tendency as humanity, as fallen creatures, we have this tendency to look at our sin and minimize it. And we have this tendency to look at God's holiness and his majesty and his glory and minimize that too. It's like we're trying to elevate ourselves to and bring God down in order that we might somehow meet in the middle. We do this very often as fallen creatures. We think this sort of way, you know, I'm not so bad and God isn't so mad, you could say. We live this out in our life. The more we try to close the chasm between sinful humanity and the holy Creator, the further we move away from the truth of Scripture, and we also minimize the power of the gospel when we do this. We minimize it in our minds and hearts. And this is what Paul is saying. God's wrath, his righteous anger, his indignation has been revealed, he says, from heaven against all the corruption and the distortion of humanity. The humanity that pushes down the truth of their sin and pushes down and suppresses the holiness of God. We feel this when we, many times, I don't know how you are, but I know for many of us, when we share the good news of the gospel with maybe someone who doesn't believe or someone that's marginally familiar with the church, you can sort of feel this pressure, like, I'm sharing news that contains an offense to it. It's news that has a rough edge to it. And that rough edge is, there is a good Creator who brought mankind into existence, and we rebelled against him. We've walked away from him. We have thrown ourselves into the deep mire of our own sin, and in that sin we are dead, and there's nothing that we can do to save ourselves and redeem ourselves. It can be hard to present this news and then to present Christ, the very one who rescues us from this, because we have to share the bad news. We have to share the significance of what has gone wrong in this world, of why things are the way we are. Our tendency sometimes can be to minimize the gospel, the breadth of it, to truncate God's story. And instead, we must realize as the church, the gospel is wide. The gospel begins with a very good creation, and it ends with a new creation. It is this wide. The gospel also has a height and a depth to it. The depth of, we are rebellious sinners, and we have sinned against a holy and righteous God, this God to which there is no other that is comparable to him. The height of which this gospel speaks is infinite, because the holiness and the righteousness and the majesty of God is unable to be fully expressed. So this deep and wide gospel is what we carry as the church, and it's what our secular world, as James Smith calls the secular age in which we live, it is what this secular age desperately needs to hear. Is this good news? It's easy to comply sort of with the general notion that, you know, we can get this sort of sentiment sometimes, maybe around the holidays, that, you know, the really important thing in life is that we're kind to each other and we treat others fairly. And we kind of leave it there. It's like period on the sentence. That's it. Let's not get further into it because, you know, it's going to get into conflict if we do. And that's sort of the general notion that we step into many times. And parts of this are admirable, but this fails miserably to address the fundamental problem. And that is, we sit under God's wrath, his just condemnation. And we all, every single human being, is without excuse, Paul tells us. He says in verse 19, for what can be known about God is plain to them because God has shown it to them. Verse 20, for his invisible attributes, namely his eternal power and divine nature, have been clearly perceived. They've been seen since the creation of the world in the things that have been made. So they are without excuse. So they are without excuse. The painful questions we raise concerning those who will never hear the gospel, this is a really difficult thing, I think, for many Christians to wrestle with and think about, is that there are some in the world today that will die, that will go into the grave, having never heard the good news. But what Romans 1 tells us is actually that God has been on display to them through the creation. Theologically, this is more of a general form of revelation, God revealing himself to them. There is intelligence in the world. There is glory that is to be taken in. There is a creator. This has been clearly perceived. So they are without excuse. So they are without excuse. This is hard for us sometimes to wrestle with, this reality. This is, in the world in which we live, especially the day and age in which we live, it's one of the reasons why for me, listening to, and this is maybe getting into a specific aspect of our culture, but capital A atheism, like atheism that says there is no God. Not an agnostic form that says, I really don't know. And this may be some of you here this morning that believe this way, but a capital A atheist that says there is no God. It's why it is so frustrating for me. Not the person, but the thinking. I was on a flight several years ago to Florida. There were some meetings that our church was engaged in at the time. And I got seated next to a gentleman who was a capital A atheist. I struggled to share a story about talking to a guy on a plane because I think that's a very typical pastor story. But I'll do it anyway. But I got seated next to this gentleman and he sat down. And probably within the first 5 or 10 minutes of our conversation, I discovered that he's an atheist. Like he is an atheist. And he discovered that as a Christian. And not only a Christian, but a pastor. And so our flight was, I don't remember how long it was, 3 or 4 hours or something like that. And so pretty much the entirety of that flight, we were in conversation. And much of his questions related to me. He would come at me with these questions of how in the world can you submit yourself and serve a God who's okay with all of this suffering in the world, who's okay with the violence of warfare and kids who never find out who their parents are and all these sorts of things, a litany of things. And I just found myself time and time again just baffled in my thinking. Like, in my head, I'm trying to go back to him and go, can you just help me understand? There's a moral framework to your conscience. Like, there is something about that that bothers you, that digs at you, that gets under your skin. Like, help me to understand where that comes from. Help me to understand why you feel this at such a deep and significant level, to the point where you are like, he was turning red in a couple moments. Like, it was intense on that flight. Like, no attendants were called over. You know, we all made it off the plane. He was getting excited. And I'm like, where does this come from? And this is part of, I think, what is frustrating for me. And I wasn't frustrated with that man. I still think of him often and pray for him. I pray he's following Jesus. But what's frustrating for me is the mindset and the religious devotion that this gentleman exhibited that day. This religious devotion to there is no God, and I can live my life without him. And yet, the brokenness of this world really bothers me, and it gets under me, and it's hard for me to wrestle with. And to which my question is, why is it hard for you? What ethically is being trampled on? And where do those ethics come from? It's a little bit like if you've seen Buster Keaton the visual comedian, there's a moment in one of his sketches where he's sitting on a plank building a house, and he's sitting on the outside of the plank, and he's sawing the plank off, right? And if you're familiar with his comedy, it's highly visual. There's no audio other than just music. And he's sitting on the plank, and you know what's going to happen. He's going to saw through the plank, and he's going to fall down. And that's kind of what this feels like to me. It's, what are you sitting on with this? And so we shared, we got off the plane, but largely this moment just sort of sits in my mind as a continual reminder of the blindness of the age and the truth of what Paul says here, that we are without excuse. And there will come a day when our allegiance to this type of secular blindness will be fully revealed, and we won't be able to say, I didn't know. We won't be able to say, I didn't know that. Paul says that we're without excuse. This blindness has come, and this is the focal point here of where Paul is driving us. It has come because we failed to honor God, and we failed to give thanks to him as creator and sustainer. He says in verse 21, for although they knew God, they did not honor him as God or give thanks to him, but they became futile in their thinking, and their foolish hearts were darkened. Now this word futile that Paul uses here is a similar word to the writer of Ecclesiastes, this word hevel. This word that causes us to look and go confusion, puzzled, baffling, elusive. The meaning of whatever is there is unseen. That's kind of what this word is pushing us towards. As many of you know, our family just moved into a house just a couple months ago, 2.5 months ago, and we're a lot of kind of renovation going on in the Hart household. But this home was built in 1959, and we bought it from the original owner. He was an engineer at Honeywell for 35 plus years, and he did a lot of unique little fun things on this house, like really, really cool things. And as we're working on stuff and we're discovering some of the neat little nuances, we'll come across something that doesn't make sense to us. Like, we'll look at it and we'll go, okay, that's kind of strange. That doesn't exactly make sense why that's there or why that, you know, feeds into this. But I know the owner, and I know he was very smart, and I know he didn't really do anything without intentionality. And so a part of me goes, Josh, just because you can't see the meaning of why that is the way it is, it doesn't mean that meaning is not there. And I can say this with you with confidence. Every time that's happened, that's been proven true. Whereas a day or two later, I'll go, oh, that's why he hooked it up this way. That's why he set it up this way. And this is true of our world. That our blindness has caused us to look at our world and scratch our heads. Why are things this way? And many have thrown up their arms, well, there is no meaning, where rather in the eyes of the Christian, we say, no, there is intentionality to this world, there is meaning to the way that things are. It has been intricately designed by and for the Creator. And when we try to create our own meaning, or when we blind our eyes to the simple reality of the meaning and purpose in the world, it just shows how futile our thinking has become, how darkened our minds have become. And so Paul here, he directs us to this. He directs us to the bad news that makes the good news so good. He shows us how failing to give thanks to God is at the heart of our rebellion. It's right at the heart of our rebellion as humanity. Paul directs our attention to the moment this world was cast into this kind of futility, grasping at meaning, this moment when it took place, this moment when our corporate rebellion that began with Adam and Eve, when they took the fruit from the tree for themselves, showing that instead of being grateful for all that God had provided for them, he had been so gracious to give them, instead they grasped for that divine status, taking the initiative to disobey and to dishonor God. Essentially saying to themselves, I must take for myself what God has not provided. I must take for myself what God will not provide for me. And they took the fruit and they ate it, and futility and darkness and sin was ushered into the world through this. This rebellion that initiated with Adam and Eve in the garden, it calls to us. It calls to us to live as though God didn't exist, to place ourselves on the throne of our own lives. And when we do this, we are exercising the opposite of gratitude. We're exercising the opposite of giving thanks to God and directing our worship and our thanks to Him. See, giving thanks to God rightly directs our attention and the attention of others to the true source. But our rebellion means that we give credit to created things. We place the good gifts that God has placed in our hands on the throne of our lives. I think it's so interesting that just immediately following Thanksgiving for us as a culture is a day of frenzied consumerism. I don't think that's an accident. And I think for Christians, it needs to yet be a reminder of this. This is a natural reaction. When our thanks is not directed towards God, the natural reaction is to try to grasp something, to get a hold of something, to fill ourselves with something, to find meaning in something. I'm not saying that's the motivation of everybody that goes out on Black Friday. Don't hear me say that. But it is interesting that as a culture, this is a moment for us. This is a really significant moment for us. We run to the gifts and not the giver for life. We exchange the presence of God for the presence that He provides. We set our hope on the good things that God has provided instead of being rightly set on God Himself. The significance of giving thanks to God is probably more, far more significant than we realize. This is a posture of our entire life. This is something that Paul is directing us towards. Although we knew God, we did not honor Him as God or give thanks to Him. So let's return to that opening question. The question that we'll be pondering this week, prayerfully, with the help of God's Spirit, thinking about this week. Where is your thanks directed in your life? Where is your gratitude pointed? See, we give thanks ultimately to God. We give thanks to Him for who He is. We give thanks to Him for what He has done. Who is God? God is a creator and the sustainer of the cosmos. He's brought you into existence. He is the good and gracious ruler of the world. He is king of His creation. He's the director of all history. He's the giver of every good gift. What has God done? He's been patient with you. He's showed His kindness towards you. He's pursued you with His love. He's come after you, Christian. He's pursued you all the way to the point of death. Romans says, Paul says to us in Romans, that we have exchanged the good things of God for lies, for the gifts instead of the giver. And God has exchanged His life for yours. He's taken on Himself your rebellion and sin, your blindness and darkness. He's taken the weight of that on Himself, and He's paid for it through Christ on the cross. And He's given you life. True life that can be found nowhere else. A meaning that can be discovered in no other place or through no other person than Jesus. So where do we direct our thanks? Where do we direct our praise? Where do we direct our worship? But to God alone. Let's pray. God, we come to You humbled to consider what you have done for us, sinners. Sinners that are in your hands. A God who is righteously angry, who is so because you are good. And it would not be good for you to look on the brokenness of your creation and the chaos and the violence and be unmoved. But, oh God, you love us and you care for us. And out of your great love, you have shown yourself to us. And you have pursued us. And so, God, this week, as we think about this moment that we are going to have on Thursday, and for many of us, this is an annual event that we celebrate with family and friends, I pray, oh Lord, that in our minds and on our lips and in our hearts, that our thanksgiving, our giving thanks would be directed to the true source, that it would be directed to you, O God. I pray that we would realize this gratitude, the gratitude that overflows, that never runs dry, only comes through faith in the living Christ and what he has done. And God, as we do so, help us to be winsome with the world and bold with the world and courageous for the sake of the gospel. Help us to be a church that expresses this gratitude out of a deep sense of who we are and out of a deep sense of who you are, O God, and what you've done. We give you praise and thanks in the name of Christ. Amen.